just don't know what to do, y'all.
Sedition? Yes. Mojo 5-0. With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0. Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
Welcome to the Sam Sorbo Show. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to start off today with an interview with a gentleman I met last night. Brian is the executive director of a medical practice here in Orange County, California. As you can see from perhaps my background, I'm traveling, and this is a broadcast from a hotel room. He founded We the People OC, that's the Orange County, last year because of his opposition to the public health COVID guidances, which were not based on medical science. Ooh, careful. This might be medical disinformation and they might take me down. But no, he's the director of a medical practice. And so now he is taking on the government, frankly. And so I thought it would be very interesting to bring him on the show, to bring you guys a little bit of what one person is doing to fight back against City Hall. Welcome to the program, Brian Eisley.
Thank you, Sam. I greatly appreciate you allowing me to be here. The message is really important. And with the disinformation that's going on in the mainstream media, people don't know what to believe and what not to believe. So I appreciate it very much.
Yeah. So, but you're taking a kind of a different approach. So I don't mind getting into all the COVID stuff, but I mean, and obviously this is related to the COVID stuff, but you're taking sort of a political position on this by getting into the city council, into the politics of it. And so what is it that you're doing and how do you want to encourage people to engage? Because there are a lot of people out there who are saying, there's stuff going on that I disagree with, and the government is involved in a way that I disagree with that is perhaps not constitutional, right? And so that's really right. Where we're coming at this. So take it away.
Okay. So, and I'll touch on COVID for just a minute because that's the right for why this happened. But so the real issue. I'm sorry about this, that most people have right now in the medical community is that the public health directives, which are very simplistic, stay home, wear a mask, stay 6 feet apart, and wait for a vaccine, is misguided at best. I'm going to be kind and say it's misguided at best because it is absolutely, positively a ridiculous stance. We had, according to the CDC, we've had about 6,000 people die of COVID. Our stance is if they had received early, correct treatments, half of them would not have died. So the death rate is exceptionally high because of medical malpractice. And that starts with our public health department. And it started with Tony Fauci, who clearly said, oh, you have to wear a mask. And then been this wear a mask, don't wear a mask, wear a mask, don't wear a mask. I don't know. Maybe we need two. Now maybe we need three. Let's double down and do four. You know, all this stuff. And it appears to me it's meant to just confuse people and they don't really know what is what. So
if we're going with the misguided viewpoint, then maybe they are just confused.
Well, trying to be kind, we'll say they're confused. The facts are that the masks don't work, for example. There's plenty of data on that. In fact, the irony of Fauci, again, just recently stating masks are an effective tool, is on his own website. On his own website, November 20th of 2020, they published a study from Stanford University saying that masks don't work. It's on his own website. And yet, he's out here espousing that. So the problem we have is in our locals, they have followed the same guidance. And it is based on false information. And it's actually harming people rather than helping people. It's harmed us in many, many ways. So what I had to do was we sat down and we said, you know what? We got to make a difference somehow. And what can that be? So what it turned out to be was, well, we started looking into what our board of supervisors are doing here in Orange County. And for those people who don't know what a board of supervisors are, they are the legislative power in a county. Now, some states call them commissioners and some places call them parish, you know, such and such, but it's all the same. They are the administrative and the legislative arm of our local government, and they are very powerful. Our board of supervisors has an $8 billion a year budget that they spend. $8 billion. That's pretty friggin' powerful.
Well, and you said they're both legislators and administrators.
So they carry a dual role. So that's the problem. So they set policy and then they tell people what to do. I apologize. I was at that stupid conference in Anaheim over the weekend and now I've got this stupid cough I can't get rid of. So anyway, we decided that we needed to do something because I tried for a year and a half to get our supervisors to read science. I sent them emails with links. I sent them a 55-page document with 5 pages of citations on medical science showing that if we were to just open up and let people go on with their lives, we would have been through this a long time ago because most of the people are not going to get sick and die from COVID. That's just a gross misrepresentation. But yet you would think from hearing the news that, oh my God, people are dying every day. There's bodies piling up in the street and all this kind of stuff. And there's not. And there won't be. You know, the average age of a person who died is 78 years old.
And what is the definition of pandemic? Because I've been pushing back on people saying, well, we're still in a pandemic. And I'm like, no, I think the pandemic ended when it actually almost never began because we shut everything down. And so we avoided a pandemic. Wasn't that the whole point?
That was the point. So the WHO changed the definition of a pandemic about 7 years ago now. So it used to be a disease that spread around the world causing significant death. That's the key thing, causing significant death. So a few years ago, they changed it. And now they call it a novel virus that spreads around the globe. There's no talk of death and there's no talk of disease.
Well, then we're always in a pandemic. There's always a pandemic. And well, by the way, this feeds beautifully with my book, Words for Warriors, where I'm pointing out that they just changed the definitions and you think that they mean one thing. You think that they're talking about a pandemic. Scary, because a pandemic actually is scary because it's a very bad thing. But in this case, they've changed the definition of pandemic so they can say pandemic. You think that it's a very scary thing, but in fact, it's not. It's just a bug that's going around.
Right. And then they did that intentionally because if they can declare a pandemic, then other things happen. So when you declare a pandemic, then all of a sudden the public health officials become the primary director and all sorts of legislation is sidelined. So for example, the government normally requires you to do what they call 3 bids. So if you want to award a contract to a company, they give you a proposal and then they also have to have 2 other companies that come in and get proposals and then they pick the best of the 3. That's there to keep from cronyism from happening. In a pandemic, those are waived. So this last year and a half, our CEO in Orange County has had the ability to pick a company and hand them a contract without public discussion. They just do it. And that's exactly what's happening. And they are refusing.
You know, if I were a cynic, I would be saying, this just looks like a tremendous power grab.
Well, I think you aren't being cynical when you say that. I think that you are correct. It is a power grab, honestly.
Being mildly observant.
Yeah, being mildly observant. If you just woke up this morning, you would realize this. So it's very blatant. They're not trying to hide it. So our board of supervisors actually has said, they said this. So last year, March the 2nd, they passed an emergency order because of the pandemic that was coming. That order says that we will suspend all of this stuff because there is an imminent threat of death. When they set this up a year and a half ago now, there wasn't one person sick with COVID in Orange County, California. And yet they passed an emergency order saying that we were in imminent peril.
Okay. So I want to fast forward because we're going to run out of time on this segment. Okay. And so I want to get to action points for people. You're taking on the Board of Supervisors. Other people in other areas of the country are either worse off or as badly off as you guys are in Orange County. And I mean, I thought Orange County was sort of conservative, but this seems to transcend, in a sense, traditional politics.
It does. So what we had to do was we sat down, we figured out, okay, these guys are just basically ignoring everything that the public wants. So our population in this county is very conservative, and they believe that you should be able to have your businesses open, go to church, et cetera, right? And we were locked out of all of that. So we started looking, and all five of the supervisors, regardless of party, we're voting 5-0 to keep us locked down. We're voting for all of these things. So we said, what can we do? And the only thing we can do, because we're in the middle of an election, we're not in an election cycle at the moment, is do what's called a recall. So we started looking in to what does it take to get these people out of office? And that's what we did. So it's a process. The first 90 days are legal. You've got a piece of paperwork you fill out. Then you turn it in, then they respond to you, and then you do another piece of paper and they respond to you. And it goes back and forth for about 90 days. We're in the middle of that. Well, we're at the end of that right now. Within 2 weeks, we will actually be going out to get signatures to recall these guys. So what a recall means is that we as people have failed to take and hold our government officials accountable because we allowed them to get to the point where they're out of control. And that's exactly what we have here. The spending is out of control, all sorts of stuff. So the recall has been kind of interesting. We served the board of direct supervisors with the recall notices. Their reactions were very interesting. They don't like it. They're very angry. They are making all sorts of nasty statements. Like they called me a racist. And I'm like, my team that I have put together for this is multicultural. So we have more ethnics on our board than we do non-ethnics.
Yeah, but they don't mean racist in the traditional sense of the word. They just mean you disagree with me.
Exactly.
Therefore, you're a racist.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay, so yeah. you've got to collect signatures.
Correct. So the process is you do what's called an intent to circulate a petition, and that has, in our case, 30 signatures, which was easy to get. Then they respond to our accusations, and then we actually put that in the newspaper, and we have to run a public notice on it. And then once we get everything lined up, then they say, you can go ahead and get signatures. So we have to have about 40,000 signatures per supervisor, and that is based on population of the district.
Here's what's amazing is you basically need their permission for you to go after them.
Yep.
But that's just procedural. That's because there's
just procedural
in place.
Right.
So, Brian, I want to take a quick break here. For those of you listening on radio and podcast, I'll be right back with more of the show. If you want more with Brian, go to sorbos.locals.com for more of this content. I'm going to continue the interview with Brian and find out next steps, and then where you might be able to go to start this kind of procedure yourself. So stay tuned, and I'll be right back for radio and podcast. And for those of you watching on video, thanks for watching. Don't forget to subscribe and go over and see me at sorbos.locals.com. And welcome back to the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm your host, Sam Sorbo. I have another guest that I've been very much looking forward to to speaking with. He's a colonel, Andy O'Meara, and he's written a new book called Liberty Versus Tyranny. And he served as a cavalryman, an infantryman, a tankerman in troop units in Europe, Vietnam, and the U.S. He's published several different works, including articles and newspaper, professional journal articles. But I wanted to talk to him about his new book, Liberty Versus Tyranny. Welcome to the program, Colonel Andy O'Meara.
Thank you so much.
So talk to me about this book. First of all, why now? Why this book? What makes it so timely?
I've been working on this book for many years. It's a book about communist revolutionary warfare, wars of national liberation. When I went to Vietnam the first time, I recognized we did not understand our enemy. And so I resolved to study and work and try to understand the enemy better. And this book is a product of the efforts to write articles and publicize the nature of the communist revolutionary movement.
So it seems to be really the theme now, because, and I guess it's because they've really kind of taken the wheels off, or I can't think of a good analogy, but it does seem to have really ramped up. What do you attribute that to?
They've been at work for over a century in the United States, fighting the United States. I'm talking about the Communist Party and before them, the Socialists. John Dewey and his friends in the academic community. They've been pushing communism steadily, but they've done it underground, secretly. Now they've broken out into the open, and we see them, and we see the revolutionary movement in full swing.
Right. So talk to me about the rules of engagement with the Taliban. I know that you cover that a little bit in the book. Talk to me about that.
The rules of engagement were permitted our soldiers to fight as we normally fight. Obama changed those rules, and what he instituted is that American soldiers could not load their weapons until they had been fired upon. And they could not engage a target until the target fired at them. Those were rules that put our soldiers in great danger.
They actually couldn't carry loaded weapons?
We were forced to carry unloaded weapons when the soldiers went into combat. This was almost a suicidal policy that he introduced.
And so... But unpack that a little bit for me. How did he get that employed in the armed services?
The president is the commander in chief. What he orders us to do, we do. And so he ordered that these rules of engagement be adopted. I think they were probably recommended to him by the Muslim Brotherhood,
which is a separate, okay, is there a distinction between the Muslim Brotherhood and the communists, would you say?
Yes, indeed. The Communist Party USA was instituted originally by Lenin, and it came under the Comintern and supervised by Stalin. The Taliban is a Muslim organization. It is a body that was governing in Afghanistan at the time of 9/11.
Right, but ideologically, how are they different?
One pursues Islam, and Islam is at war with Judeo-Christian culture. The Marxists are at war also, but they're war with Western civilization. So the U.S. is part of the Judeo-Christian culture. The U.S. is part of Western civilization. So we're the target of both.
And likely for the same reason.
Indeed. I think many of the similar reasons. The doctrine instituted by Muhammad, the prophet, said that the Muslim community, Islamic community, had to continually fight until the world was converted to one faith under Allah. So they've declared unending war against the West. In the case of the communists, they also intend to convert everyone to their beliefs.
Okay. In the book, you also go into our foreign policy. So talk to me about the shifts that have been made in our foreign policy and how that has affected our role in the world.
The U.S. Has pursued a policy of protecting the U.S. national interests. As we recognized that the Soviet Union was waging a war against our national interest, we being the U.S. Congress, instituted a deterrence policy. And what it tried to do is deter Russia from exporting revolution through military force, or exporting communism through force. And that put us in a confrontational posture with the Soviet Union and with socialism in general. Also placed us as an opponent of the Communist Party in China and of the insurgencies that Mao launched that he called wars of national liberation.
And so where does that leave us today? I'm sure you're following foreign policy decisions that the current administration is making and the previous one.
Right now, we're in a state of great confusion. We see our national government instituting socialist policies that are pushing our economy further and further to the left. These are not policies that are unwelcome by the Chinese Communist Party. So we see them mitigating their opposition. They were in strong opposition to the Trump administration. Trump fought against the Chinese domination of the U.S. trade and U.S. economy.
Yeah, I mean, that was his original platform. That's what he ran on. And he made headway until there was a virus that accidentally got out of a lab, according to some people.
Indeed.
Go ahead.
Many of us who have served in the military believe that was a biological warfare attack upon the United States. It was deliberate and was an act of war.
Well, it's odd because Fauci predicted that it would happen in Trump's term in office. So, but that prediction was back in 2018, and there's no way that he could have known that it was going to happen. That was just a fluke. So let's talk about the riots that we saw over the summer that were good riots. Then there was that brief thing that happened in the Capitol that apparently was the worst day in U.S. history, according to the left. But the riots, there was very little effort to contain or deter from them. How does that fit into the puzzle?
The communists are waging class warfare. They're waging gender warfare. They're pursuing racial warfare policies. Those policies are carried out, the warfare is carried out by Black Lives Matter, and Antifa. Those are agents pursuing the communist revolution in America. Now, the left called these riots that they started in Kenosha and in New York City, wherever,
Portland.
They called those peaceful demonstrations, despite the fact that businesses were burned, police were killed. They were full riots, and they were attacks on the United States of America and our communities. But the left called those peaceful. Why? Because they advanced their interests. They advanced the communist revolution in America, which the socialists, which today includes the Democratic Party, are advancing.
Okay, so final question. And thank you, by the way, for coming on. I'm talking with Colonel Andy O'Meara, and he's written this book, Liberty versus Tyranny. Last question. You know, we've been fighting this war on drugs for a very long time. And I want to get your insights on why we're not seeing results.
The war that we're waging against drugs is being sponsored, a large part of it, by the Chinese Communist Party that are making drugs available and to be smuggled across the border. Now, the cartels in Latin America and South America, those cartels are moving drugs also, but they're in competition with the Chinese drug traffic.
So you're saying that basically we think that we're fighting the war over here, but actually our enemies over here feeding all the different areas where we're fighting this war?
The Chinese Communist Party, through the People's Congress, has declared people's war on the United States of America, and the drug traffic that the Chinese are pushing, Chinese Communist Party is pushing, is one element of the people's war. Other elements are, you know, biological warfare.
Right. Which you're also claiming that we're seeing. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the program. The name of the book again is Liberty versus Tyranny by Colonel Andy O'Meara. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm going to take a quick break. If you're listening on radio or podcast, I'll be right back with more of the show. And thank you so much. This is the Sam Sorbo Show. All right, welcome back to the Sam Sorbo Show. I have a couple things I want to talk about right now that are just kind of fun and a little a little off-putting. First of all, did you guys see when Rand Paul took on Fauci? Fauci was testifying, and Rand Paul said, "Do you understand that it's a felony to lie? And are you aware that you told us under you know oath that there was no gain of function research at the Wuhan lab? And yet I've got a document here where you write exactly what they're doing at the Wuhan lab, which fits the definition of gain of function." And they went back and forth, and it was really interesting because Fauci kind of goaded Rand Paul, told him that he was lying, told him that he was, you know, purposely misrepresenting and way out of line and didn't understand. And yet Rand Paul, who is a doctor, he's not a scientist, but he's a doctor, but he's not a lawyer, which is kind of interesting. This is why I encourage parents to teach their children speech and debate, because the idea is that you walk the person through the various steps to get them basically to admit. And so they okay. So he accused Fauci of doing gain of function research and lying about it. Then he presented the evidence of the description. First of all, he presented the evidence of the description that the NIH funded this research. Then he presented the description of the research, which is taking taking animal viruses and somehow enhancing them so that they can then work on humans. That is actually the very definition of gain of function research. And it is exactly what the researchers were doing. But in the meantime, Rand Paul said, your people will need to be prosecuted for doing this kind of research, for doing, no, he said people would be prosecuted for releasing a virus that caused millions of deaths. And Fauci took offense at that and distracted from the discussion about gain of function research and his role and his representation of gain of function research by saying there's, you can't, correlation is not causation. You can't claim that, this research caused those deaths. You see, they're like parsing everything and splitting it up into little pieces. And then they can say, no, this is wrong because it's like just a little piece of it. But, you know, we have to go back to what is, It's not the letter of the law, it's the essence of the law. What's the intention? The intention was that the United States would not fund this kind of research. They put a pause. They didn't just say never. They put a pause because the people who were doing that saw that there was some danger, some tremendous danger, more than was acceptable. And so the U.S. should not fund it. Frankly, I don't understand why they don't see Planned Parenthood and abortion the same way. I honestly, but that's a different topic. I'm getting off topic. So they put a pause on the funding, and Fauci apparently said, well, they can put a pause on that funding, but they're not the ones writing the check. So I'll still write the check because I can. That's, and I believe that's the contention that, that Rand Paul was bringing up, and it got kind of nasty. I got to say, I mean, it was a pretty hefty back and forth. Okay. So Reuters responded to an accuracy in media action alert, accusing them of a double standard in reporting COVID in Cuba and in America. And instead, they tried to avoid taking the blame for those editorial decisions by blaming the World Health Organization. And yet they weren't even quoting the World Health Organization. They were quoting the Pan American Health Organization. Quote, the gathering of individuals for protests increases the risk of transmission in particular cases such as Cuba, where you have active transmission in many areas over the last week and 34,000 new cases reported. But that goes in, that goes completely contrary to what they reported over the summer when people were looting and rioting, and it served their purposes because it furthered the communist agenda. You understand that people in Cuba are protesting against communism, therefore COVID risk. But over the summer, when people were protesting that furthered the communist agenda because it was just divisive and destructive and just fomented more rage and more hate, that was okay. And that did not run the risk of excessive COVID. I can't make this stuff up. And so I'm going to ask you this question. Can a bag of Lay's potato chips save your life? Think about it. but don't think too long because I'm going to give you the answer. They're calling this guy the New York Police Department's own MacGyver. He came upon a stabbing victim. He was hailed down and rushed over to a stabbing victim. The victim had a knife wound on his right chest, in his chest on the right hand side, that likely had punctured his lung. And the NYPD officer, who was a first responder, was trained as an EMT only recently, actually. He immediately thought that he had to stop. He had to close the hole because if air got in there, it would collapse the lung. So he asked for a bag of potato chips because they are airtight. And then he and tape, and he taped the bag of potato chips on the chest right over the knife wound to prevent the puncture from admitting air and collapsing the lung. He says, "I was looking specifically for the size, that size bag, the squared edges, and that type of material that wouldn't allow air to pass through it. It was that split decision that doctors said made all the difference in saving this individual's life." The man was 29 years old. There was a bystander who flagged them down. He goes, "Get me a bag of potato chips right now." Officer, there's a man who's been stabbed. Help. Okay, get me a bag of potato chips. I'm sorry, but it's funny because it ended well. Okay. I wouldn't be laughing if it hadn't ended well. They taped the bag of potato chips on the man's chest. And, the officer David Galindez, who collared the attacker, said he thought it was crazy to use a chip bag, but only for a split second. He said, "I know Kennedy," that is the name of the officer who treated the individual. He said, "I know Kennedy has prior EMT experience, and I knew that was, so he knew that was going to work." And by the way, it had immediate effect, which is kind of cool. When Kennedy had finished taping that thing up, this victim, he breathed right in right away. The bag had a dramatic improvement on his condition. So if you're wondering if a bag of Lay's potato chips, or any potato chips for that matter, might save your life, it's true, but you can't eat them. Actually, they probably could have eaten them and it would have been fine. I wonder, you know, if I were that guy, I would have like saved that bag of potato chips and enshrined it in my home. "This is the bag of potato chips that saved my life." By the way, on a more somber note, the United Kingdom, well, this is reported on Breitbart, actually. In the United Kingdom, you have five times more children dying of suicide than of COVID in the first year of the lockdown. Because we've come around a full year now. And you have five times more children dying of COVID, dying of self-inflicted wounds, dying of suicide, killing themselves. If you think this isn't nefarious, and you know, we can say that they mean to do it. We can say that they don't know what they're doing. The outcome is the same. All right, quick break here. If you're listening on podcast and radio, we'll be right back with my last guest. This woman is a firecracker, so stay tuned for that. And for the rest of you, just keep tuning into these videos. Thanks for watching. Thanks for subscribing, liking, sharing. I really appreciate it. I'm trying to get this message out. This is the Sam Sorbo Show. Hi there. Welcome back to the Sam Sorbo Show. You've already seen a sneak preview of my guest because my Zoom is going back and forth. My guest is a lawyer, but she's a 24-year veteran of the public schools in New York and in Yonkers and New York public school districts. She's a lawyer now. She's very impassioned about children's parents and constitutional rights. So we're going to have a right conversation with my guest, Trisha Lindsay. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Sam. Thank you for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Well, we've been trying to work this out for a little while. Trisha and I both spoke at a rally up in Connecticut a short while ago, and she is a fire pistol something. It's just amazing, and I was blown away by her fervor and her passion. And so, but the other thing is, of course, her cause is phenomenal and very, very timely right now, children's and parents' rights. So let's start there. Walk me through, you know, you served in the public schools for 24 years. What was the big change for you? What was your drop dead moment where you went, oh?
You know what? It had been coming for a while. And I was, you know, we get familiar and comfortable in spaces that we're in. But I am a change agent, have always been a change agent. And so I was beginning to get very uncomfortable in my comfortable position. And I knew that there was something more that I should have been doing. And so as an educator, if you're a true educator, you know, fully bought into what you're doing, you play numerous roles. You wear a number of hats. And I think I wore a significant number, even more than that. So I was a teacher. I was an administrator, quasi-administrator, but I also ran after-school programs. I developed different programs for kids because I realized, you know, the lack, what they weren't receiving within the school districts and when they lived in certain areas. But then I also saw how that was leading to issues and issues with law enforcement. And then
hold on. I'm sorry. I got to unpack that. You were trying to the things that you were doing wasn't leading to law enforcement issues.
No.
Okay.
No. Sorry. No, I developed programs because I realized that if children don't have enough activities and if they don't have certain services within their communities, right, they're left to, I mean, parents are working, the communities and districts that I worked in, you had working class, you had lower income people, children that were considered at risk, and middle class. So I worked in a variety of different districts. But the school that I worked in Yonkers, the schools, 95% of the children were below the poverty line, right? They were a number of immigrant children. So you had kids who were falling prey to the criminal justice system and parents who were afraid to speak out because of their immigration status or because they just didn't have time. They were working 2 and 3 jobs and trying to keep food on the table, right? So they were lacking educational services and parents were trying to advocate for them, but weren't able to the level that they should have been or would have been able to.
And a lot of times they don't even know, like, how do I address this? How do I combat this? Where do I turn? Right.
Absolutely. And then you had kids that were falling prey to the criminal justice system. Whether it was, and to be honest with you, the kids that I taught, I'm not going to downplay any wrongs that they did. But what I started to see was a number of kids coming into class and having these discussions based upon rights of theirs that were being violated. And the last story that did it for me was one of my students. He said he was in a store and I walked into class that day. They're having free time and right before we start class. And they're speaking about an incident that occurred over the weekend. And they're laughing and joking. And as I'm listening to this story, I said, this sounds bizarre and it sounds crazy. And why are you all laughing? So what happened was he was in a store. He went to buy some snacks or whatever. Police officers ran into the store, saw him, grabbed him by the neck and shoulder, threw him down on the ground and kicked him a couple times, hit him a couple times, then grabbed him, stood him up and said, and was accusing him of a crime. And he said, what are you all doing? First of all, I'm only 14 and you're putting your hands on me. And he said, I didn't do anything. And he said, you must have done something. We know you did something. And it was, you know, and they were just laughing. And I said, well, who were they looking for? He said, Miss Lindsay, I don't know who they were looking for, because to this day, they didn't tell me who they were looking for. And I said, but why are you all laughing at this? They said, because it's funny. I said, what's funny about this? They said, Miss Lindsay, this happens all the time in our neighborhood. And I said, what do you mean it happens all the time? They said, this happens all the time. This is a regular thing. Police officers just run in, run on us. They hit us, they grab us, they arrest us. They do whatever they want to do. So we kind of get used to it. And we just, you know, we'll get bailed out, or they take us downtown, bother us, harass us, put us in the back of their car, and then let us out. So I said, okay, this is not funny. You know, you have rights. And so we went on, and, you know, and I spoke to them about police officers. I said, there are great police officers, but there are a few that are not so good. And when your rights are being violated, you have to know that. You, first of all, you need to know your rights to understand they're being violated. And you have to know how to fight them and how to deal with it so that you don't get yourself in greater trouble, you know. And I just wanted them to be able to stand up. And so I felt like I was starting to have to advocate for them, dealing with probation officers. I was dealing with different agencies in the community. Then I was reaching out and trying to build partnerships with the schools, with different businesses in the communities to offer services to the kids to keep them out of trouble, because they were really good kids, you know, and they were just did not have the services and the direction that they needed. And so that led me to it. And I realized how the school system added to that problem. And that is something I had been watching for years. I had been watching the decline of the school system, and I was watching the agenda that was in place that was not about educating kids. It really was not. And so that's why what's happening now with the COVID-19 and the vaccines and the erosion of our rights as parents and our right to bodily integrity and autonomy and these things, this has been in the works for years. This is nothing new. This is nothing new. But all the entities are now coming together, and the puzzle is coming together. The pieces of the puzzle are being put together. But unfortunately, most of us are still seeing them as separate entities and separate agendas. And some people, and many of us, don't even realize it's an agenda that is happening. So when I realized, first of all, you can't eat and crap in the same place, right? So if I'm going to fight the system that I'm working in, that's going to be a problem. So because they are paying me a salary, they control me, right? When someone is paying you a salary, they control you to a certain extent. So I realized I had to get out of the system in order to deal with the system. So this path started really with dealing with education legislation. This is really what I wanted to do, and to level the playing field within the criminal justice system for youth, at-risk youth, for Black and brown children, not to be exonerated from crimes they may commit, but to be given equal sentences in line with their white counterparts. And that's pretty much where it started.
And so is it fair to say that you started out as an educator and then went to law school?
Yes. Yes.
Just that is such a message to people that, you know, you can choose a career path and then say, you know, this doesn't serve where I see myself in 10 years. So, yeah, I imagine you went to law school at night.
Yes, I was working full time, still raising a family, and went to law school at night. And I finished the semester ahead of time. And if I could have done it in a year ahead of time, I would have. But that's the fastest that they will allow you to complete law school. So I realized that I had reached the pinnacle of my career. And I was teaching. As an educator, yes. And I had the capabilities of being a principal and even being a superintendent, because I went and got the degrees, have the licenses and things of that sort. But I only wanted the information. I wanted the information so that when I approached Congress, when I dealt with legislation, I could understand it from all lenses, right? I understood it as a parent. I understood it now as an educator, and I wanted to understand it from the standpoint of an administrator, vice principal or principal. And I was the science department chairperson, so I was the liaison between central office, which is a district head office, and the teachers and parents. So I understood it from even that higher level administration. And so when I'm speaking of education, when I'm speaking of rights, I'm speaking of it from of varied amounts of varied lenses. You know, I just don't have one perspective. And I've worked in the Bronx. I started in Catholic school. I was educated through the Catholic school system. When I began teaching, I started in the Catholic school system and then went over to the public school system. So I understand that. I understand the differences there. I understand what's needed in both of those entities, and I compare the entities. And when I was teaching in Catholic school, and because of my education, I could see the difference in what the kids were lacking in the public school arena. Now, there are wonderful public schools around this country and in certain districts, but they're not all created equal, unfortunately. And I saw the disparity in certain districts, and I felt like my services were needed there. And so that's why I switched over to public school and then did what I could do there. And I was I can pat myself on the shoulder. I was an excellent teacher, an excellent educator there. And but I had reached my pinnacle and I felt like I needed to do more. And I could not do it from the classroom. I could not do it even from the standpoint of the principal, at least not what I wanted to do.
You couldn't do it from within the system. And so now you're outside the system. And what exactly are you doing?
Well, my life was taking a turn because of COVID. So I was supposed to come out. So I'm representing clients in terms of civil rights violations, constitutional violations. I have school kids that are whose rights needs to be advocated for within the school district. So I'm doing that. Employment discrimination. You know, I am doing that. But I was headed towards dealing with education legislation in the country. That was my 32nd elevator speech, right? I was going to level the playing field, deal with the criminal justice system, level the playing field, and I was going to deal with education legislation in the country. That's not what's happening.
So what's the correlation between public school and the criminal justice system? Where's the correlation? Because obviously you see one.
Mm. That's a rabbit hole. That's a rabbit hole. And so there is what I will invite you to, if her page still exists. Diane Ravitch was the former Secretary of Education. She had a website at one time that spoke about all of this. Malcolm Gladwell speaks about this, and there are a number there. What's the other book? Oh my gosh, it'll come back to me. But there is a school to prison pipeline that exists, and it is real.
Well, I have a friend who calls public schools, at least in the inner city, calls them gang prep centers.
They're training centers for prison. If you go to the schools in the inner cities and watch the way that they are decorated, the walls, the colors that are worn, the way that the children are made to line up and walk and be quiet. And then when you go, my daughter went to boarding school for a little while, right? She went to boarding school and she was on a campus where she was allowed to run free. I mean, not wild, but you know, she took herself to class. She took herself to the cafeteria. I mean, the food that they were fed was much better quality. The classes were set up a different way. Their freedom of expression and the way in which they were taught and they learned it's a lot different.
And we're talking about that's the system. That is the system. The public school, you know, they need to impose a modicum of behavior control. And look, trust me, I'm not an advocate. But I am playing a devil's advocate for the public schools, right?
Sure.
And so they have to impose some kind of strict boundaries to make sure that bad things don't happen within the system, right? And it does look a lot like prison, because prison has the same goal, is to keep everybody calm and, you know, nonviolent. And so there are going to be those seeming correlations, right? They will look alike.
So a certain extent.
How do you not have that?
Well, as I was an administrator of the middle school, right, in my district, and the middle school, I call that the boot camp of education. Every teacher, no matter how good you are, every teacher cannot deal with middle school students because they're between being immature children and burgeoning young adults, right? Their hormones are all over the place. They're not sure if they want to be grown or they want to be children. And so then they're full of personality. I was offered to go and teach in high school, and I declined each time because high school students are boring in comparison to middle school students, but they keep you on your toes. And within that, there were guidelines, there were boundaries set up, there were things put in place to keep, to manage the children. You have a large number of children in these spaces, right? But I also had students whereby I would walk out of my classroom and go and handle things down the hall. And my students knew not to move. They would continue doing work. They would start a conversation. They knew boundaries because they respected me and I respected them. And they knew what I expected of them. And they wanted to meet those expectations. You understand?
Right, but what you're saying is that not every middle school teacher can command that kind of respect. And so then it comes down to the system and who the system employs. And listen, I need to take a quick break, but I will be coming back with Tricia Lindsay. The second part of this interview will be up on sorbos.locals.com. For those of you on radio and podcast, thanks for tuning in to the Sam Sorbo Show.
This is the seditious, rabble-rousing, liberty-loving, home of fun, entertaining, and compelling talk. Mojo 5-0.